Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the World of Ink Network, founded in 2011 by Virginia Grenier and Marcia Cook. Their vision was to start a radio show that helped writers reach their dreams. The World of Ink has a wonderful group of hosts who are dedicated to delivering shows to entertain and inspire listeners. The World of Ink Network shares resources that introduce tips, products, and services to help strengthen, support, and challenge those who love writing and the written word. Their hope is to bring not only authors, illustrators, and publishers together, but screenwriters, directors, and producers. New to the network will be a variety of special shows, bringing not only entertaining shows, but informative discussions on timely subjects. To learn more about us, go to www.worldofinknetwork.com or visit us on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you for your support and enjoy the show.
Happy New Year, everybody. This is the first show of the year, and Virginia and I are both here, and that was good. They played our message. It's a good sign for the year, I think, that everything went well. So Happy New Year again, and Virginia, hi, Virginia.
Hello.
See, we don't have to say that much anymore because we have it down. Somebody else says it for us.
We have an opening now. It's great.
I know. Happy New Year. And we have...
Yes.
We have a great guest today who you just met for the first time. He's been on several times. It's our five-year, after I'm listening to that myself, it's our five-year, like, anniversary. 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That we've been doing shows.
A long time.
And 6 years for me. Oh, my God. I don't know where the time went. Well, you can see by your daughter. Definitely.
Yes,
you started.
Right. Yeah.
That's when we found each other there. I don't, you know, and so... It doesn't, you know, it really is strange that it's all these years later. I mean, you know, you just never know. And we're probably one of the people on Blog Talk that have been here a long time.
Yeah, we're one of the longest running hosts.
Right, yeah. And I think because of Red River and Mulfran's still out there, you know, all of us started in the same time. So that's like a long time and a lot of shows. But today we have a good show. I'm not going to tell you who our guest is first. I'm going to get his name right. So I'll say everything else. First, okay, I have a show next week with Mike Pettit, and I heard him on another World of Ink show, another Blog Talk show, and I found him, Mike Pettit, and he knows a lot of different things about self-publishing, which is, you know, Gerard is here. Well, I'll say Gerard is here, and these are people that are so. Like I said, Gerard has been doing this for a lot of years, and he has a great career. And for those of the people out there that are listening, it can be done. And I want, you know, Virginia, our message has always been to everybody should continue on and don't listen to some of the things that you hear that you can't make a career, and you can, because Gerard has done it. So I'm just going to bring him right out, and then we'll talk about other things later. Gerard, how are you?
Very good. Good to hear from you again, Marcia.
I think it's all these years already for you, too, because I think that's a long time since we know each other.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it's right after the new year, and it's like you said, I think it's been 4 or 5 years now.
Yeah, it is. All right, why don't you tell everybody just some of the things that you've done and how your career really is it's going so well, and you've done a great job. I mean, that's all I could say. You know, when you started, it was great, but now it's really blossoming into the career that it should be. So tell everybody what you do.
Well, I tell you, it's a career in writing is like going down an unknown river, just letting the tides take you, because where I started and where I am now, you did talk to me 4 or 5 years ago.
No.
This wasn't on the radar what I'm doing now. So.
No, I could have known that. I actually knew that you would. So that you're one person that I really knew was going to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where there is, but I can tell you that
there is
a fun journey.
I mean, you're successful.
You're still writing.
Yes, I've been... Yeah, I've been very successful, but you know, best laid plans. Certain things that I planned to do didn't come to pass. Other things that I'd never expected came. So I guess the moral of my story is to hang in there. If you don't quit and you keep writing, that was my. I mean, everybody probably has a different success path, but I think that we all do. The one thing that we all do is we don't stop, and we don't,
right.
You know. And in the case of writers, you have to write. I mean, you simply just have to write. Last year, I wrote a lot. I didn't publish anything, which was the first time since 2011 that I didn't publish anything. But I worked on more things than I ever did. So
right.
it's just the way it goes, you know.
Yeah. Virginia, what were you going to say? I think you were going to say something.
Well, I just think what you know, Gerard said is totally dead on, because, you know, as Marcia said, we've had a lot of people on our shows over the 5 years, and there are people that we've enjoyed having on, but we can tell, okay, you know, this was their book. And when we ask them, so what are your future plans, you can tell, like, they don't really know what they're doing. And like, okay, so they're one of those ones you're like, are they, you know, flopping out there and disappear in the wind? And then there's others like, well, I don't know, but I have all these ideas and da 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 da. And you're like, okay, these are the ones that are going to continue on, because they're. And I loved what you said, because you said you got to keep writing. I mean, it doesn't sound like you set down this path going, I'm going to become the next New York Times best-selling author and make millions of dollars. Because I think when someone starts down this path
yeah.
and they think that way, like, this is how I'm going to make money. And we met so many people when the recession hit that they're like, well, I'm writing because, you know, this is a way to make money since I lost my job or whatever. We're like,
yeah,
we'll see how long they stay around. And I mean, not to be negative, it's just you can't go into this field with the whole I'm going to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's absolutely, I'm probably the idiot story of idiot stories then, because I was managing a hedge fund and gave it up to write. So that's basically doing exactly what you should. So if you want to know what you shouldn't do, you shouldn't, you know, leave managing a hedge fund to write, because, you know, I think Marcia remembers in back in, you know, in 2011, I released the first book in January 21st of 2011. Between January 21st and September 10th, I sold 47 copies. So to say that I didn't come out of the gate hot.
but the thing is, your book, the one thing was your writing was really very good, and you had your book edited. Does your wife still,
My wife is my editor, and, you know, your soulmate.
Yeah.
To give you truth, which is what you need. Ultimately, what you need from an editor is you need two things really. You need somebody that really understands the work, and you need truth. You need somebody to be that knows what they're doing, but they're not going to hold back any punches. And Lord knows, my wife, 19 years.
That's the thing.
She's
editors say some things that we're not always thrilled with, but, you know, but right off the bat, you really, you know, you pushed yourself out there. The one thing I remember that you did is you situated yourself where you met a lot of people that were good writers and gave good advice, and you followed them. And
that was really important
to your career, I think, because you got with the right people, the right answers that you needed, rather than going to people, like Virginia had said, like, we hear a lot of people and what they say, and they don't give good advice. You found people that did give good advice, and you followed them.
I remember I started right. as a musician way back in the day,
yes.
and the way you used to learn was by it's sort of like an apprenticeship. I mean, the way musicians came up is you learn from your olders, your wisers, and your betters. And so I didn't want to reinvent the wheel when I got into – when I originally wrote – before I wrote The Watchman of Ephraim, the first novel, I was shopping a Christian spec novel, and I was going to the traditional publishers back in 2010. And I got a bunch of rejections. I got some very nice letters. But they basically said, you're a great writer, you're writing a dead genre. And I said, well, I don't know what that means. And they're like, well, you can't, that, you know, Dan Brown killed Christian spec, so why don't you start writing other genres? And bottom line, I didn't leave what I was doing to do what I really didn't do it for what Virginia was talking about. I didn't do it for money. I did it because I like needing to breathe. I need to create. I need to write.
Right.
And my wife saw it, and that's why I left what I was doing. So I didn't have that money.
Motivation.
That wasn't
right.
My.
It wasn't, right.
Yeah, it wasn't the motivation for the whole thing, and that's why when the agents came to me in 2010, my career probably would have taken a whole different spin because they were ready to sign me, and I would have had a traditional publishing deal, but they wanted me as a romance author.
Yeah.
And I was like, I got married when I was 33. What I know about romance, you could fit in a thimble.
I'm
not the guy that should be writing romance.
This is the thing, because several years ago, everybody and their brother was writing romance. But what most people don't understand is everybody has it, not everybody, I should say, but all fiction books, that I've read, there's some kind of a love story in it of somebody, something happening like that. And it's not, I've heard like Nicholas Sparks say, when people say romance writers, he doesn't seem to fit that because he writes just the story that he knows. And that's what it is. You have to write what you know and just let the story go out. And if it has romance in it, it has romance. But classifying yourself as just a romance writer is, not always the best way to go, especially because you have some very different qualities. You do a lot of research. You can see in your books. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You can't just come out. And you had a lot of experience in your life that brought you to that place. And, unfortunately, some tragedy that pushed you to do your first couple of books.
Exactly, yeah. And you know what the irony of the whole thing is? When people ask me to this day, when they say, it's an action, it's an espionage, it's a Tom Clancy novel, you write spy thrillers. When they ask me, which doesn't really matter what the writer thinks anyway. Who cares what the writer thinks about it? It's up to the reader. But I always considered Chris De Niro a love story. My motivation through the whole series has been his undying love for his wife. And so it's just ironic that I turned down the romance thing in 2010 and I ended up writing what I consider a love story anyway. But I guess I did it on my own.
That's what I'm saying, though. See, because it's not classified like that. That's what one of the mistakes is now that they're making is, when people – I was an agent. I still am an agent, and I couldn't get a lot of people published that had really good books, okay? So I'm not – I feel like – I wish some of my clients from the past would have stayed in the game because they were so good. Their stories were wonderful, and they were thriller novels. They were so good, but they couldn't take it. They couldn't take the rejection, and that's what you got to take in this business is rejection because it doesn't all, come out perfect always, That's just how it is.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, if your listeners are writers, I would definitely tell you because now I'm doing a lot of speaking engagements, so I'm getting the opportunity to speak with writers, script writers, novelists, journalists,
that's great.
And a lot of the journalists, for instance, have came out and they said, I got that novel that I never published. I said, every journalist seems to have a novel that they never published. I said, why don't you publish it? And they said, I did one 20 years ago or 10 years ago, and it just didn't – I couldn't get any traction. I says, but see, that's not what you need to do. What you need to do – well, the journalists, at least, they're still writing. So as long as you're writing, you'll find your track, and that's fine.
Right.
But for people that want to – that want to do it for a living – you need to continually write. You need to continually publish so that you have enough product out there to start supporting yourself. And you have to give yourself a business plan, just like you would do if you had a pizzeria or a bakery that has a build of about, I would say for publishing now, and this could be vastly different, but I would say if you can afford a five-year plan of saying, listen, I'll be able to sustain myself with product from my revenue from my product in about 60 months. I mean, you could do it sooner if you break sooner, fine. But you'd probably be smarter to think, hey, I got to be putting out 2 to 4 full length works. I'm talking novels now, a year, in order to get where you need to be.
Right. No, we have so many people who think like they're going to write they write one book or two books and they focus so much on promoting them over and over and over again. We're like, you need to write. I mean, because Marcia and I talk about, I only have two books out, which are kids' books. And I published them, you know, definitely huge gaps between. But and a lot of it's because, you know, I was raising my now 6-year-old daughter.
Right, exactly.
Because I literally published my first picture book right when I was pregnant with Sabrina, and then I didn't get the other one published until just this past year. So, I mean, and that's, and again, I just write when I write. I mean, it was never like, you know.
But you
like
write, a lot because you write on your blog, and you're writing you're an editor. You do a lot of other things too.
Well,
so
and that was
the
thing. Yeah, and so I wasn't. But now I'm starting to go. Okay, now I want to start, you know, publishing books. But you know, we have some people who just like have as many books as I have out, and they just keep repushing them and repush them.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you said,
you need to
write. And I hear so many times from authors like yourself that are successful or starting to see the success of their writing. They're like, it's because I keep writing books. I have multiple books under my belt. Or even if they're not all published, I have the manuscript sitting there being submitted, trying to get published, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
I
was going to say last year for me was really a test of what you're talking about, because what happens is even as your career grows and you reach different plateaus, that plateau that used to be your ceiling, your sky, now becomes your floor, and now you're looking at in order to go for the next level, I had to do a lot of work that I wasn't able to publish, but it's still writing. You have to keep writing. You have to keep yourself working, even if you don't have anybody else to task you with a project. Then I would highly recommend that you come up with one yourself and you write it. And if it's not even the right one, then you'll look back and you go, you know what? What was I doing? But at least it keeps you writing and it gets you better.
Yeah.
It does make you better.
I say that all the time to myself. But, you know, I think people actually have to be honest with themselves sometimes. And, you know, like Virginia and I, you know, over the last 5 and 6 years, I've said for sure a lot of the mistakes I've made. And but it took me to the place where I need to go, and I actually need to say, like, okay, you really can write. Because, you know, you do start feeling like, okay, maybe I'm not as good as writer, because you're having all these people on shows and you're listening to them and you're trying to, you know, figure out what, because the social media came in. And when I first started writing, it wasn't about the social media. And the social media is like, I don't have writer's block except for social media. I get crazy from that because you have to keep posting things. And the thing is, you have to do that. But the limit, I'm not sure now with the limit, because we've talked about it on our shows a lot, and I haven't really talked about it with you lately, is how do you feel about all this? I mean, you're out there a lot, and what do you feel is the platform of a new writer? What should they take? Like, should they do more Facebook? Should they do more Twitter? I mean, how do you feel about it when you're out there doing PR?
You know, as far as social media went, I tested the waters back in – actually, just to show you how I am, my personality. I'm the type of guy that I pictured myself, and this is a good practice. I mean, I have friends to this day that still laugh at me because I am this knucklehead that will do this. I pictured myself a major success as a writer. I pictured it in 2009 when I was still working for a hedge fund. That's when I first started saying, when my wife was saying, you know what, because I've been writing for 30 years. I just never tried to publish. Except for a couple of times, and it was lukewarm about it. But bottom line, I always handed my works to my wife, and my wife was at the point where a lot of years she just said, you know, go back to the drawing board on that one, G. But you know what? When I finally was ready around 2009, I pictured myself as a successful writer. So what I actually did before I wrote anything or published anything, I started a website, you know, back 2009, you know. And, you know, a blog. I didn't even know what the word meant. And so I started blogging. I was blogging too much and this and that. And then I had, like you said, you mentioned before, I am the type of person that will reach out to you. If I respect you for something, I am fearless with reaching out to you. I don't care if you're the king of Siam or if you're you consider yourself, you know, in the mafia, you know, witness protection program. I'm going to find you, and you're going to get a phone call from G. It's just that people know me for doing that. And one of the people I contacted was John Locke.
Mm-hmm.
And John had sold a million copies of his self-published book.
I know. I read his book after you mentioned it. I did.
Yeah.
You said do it, and you know, I heard you talk about it, and I read it too. And this guy is really, he knows how to do PR. Oh my God.
Well, John was a very successful real estate person and marketing. He's a marketing genius anyway.
Yep.
So I had contacted him, and I'm a little, again, I guess because of coming from a rock band where the way rock bands started back in the day in the late 70s, you started with a fan base of zero, okay? So you couldn't even get your own, like, dog to like you back in those days. So you had to have a lot of self-confidence. And so I couldn't care less whether the whole world hated me, the only thing I didn't want is I didn't want people not to notice me. So that's a rock and roll thing that I took throughout my whole life. It's actually availed me. It's actually made me successful because it doesn't make me complacent, and I don't rely on other people for my self-confidence. And so when I got into publishing, I wasn't
good thing. That's like number one.
And I wasn't really impressed with the sales were impressive, but I wasn't fooling myself thinking that I'm going to talk to John Locke and now I'm going to be selling a million copies in 5 months. That wasn't my point. All I wanted to know is, what am I supposed to be doing with this? So, because you asked me, what do you think about social networking? Well, I figured I don't reinvent the wheel. This guy seems to be doing it better than anybody. And his advice to me is, gee, stop blogging so friggin' much. And I said, okay, how much am I supposed to be blogging? I see people back in those days were blogging every day. And he's like, when you have product, blog. I said, but I only put out about 2 books a year. He says, then blog twice. I said, are you serious? He said, yeah. I said, you know what? You just lifted a huge I felt like the millstone tied around my neck was now taken off of me and thrown in the ocean. I was like, are you kidding me? Because it was such a laborious thing. I don't like to phony up things. I really didn't have too much else to talk about. I was trying all sorts of different things. And he said, blog about your books, tie it in with a story, blog about your books and only do that. And so that's what I did. And from the time that I spoke to John to now, I've gained probably about 300,000. I have probably about 300,000 people on social media. And I don't you probably see me out there. I don't do it right. I don't do it often. I do whatever I want.
Well, that's what I'm doing. People think I'm crazy. I have like so many pages, and now my new thing is I'm just doing whatever I feel like. I don't care what the rules. There's no. I don't like rules really. So I'm
just be true. That's all you got to be. Right. You just got to speak the truth. Have your own point of view, which everybody brings. You know, Virginia's going to write one kind of thing and go out in one way, and you're going to go out another way, and I'm going to go out another way, and that's the one thing I don't like in writing. I don't like it in I don't like it in life, is when people think that they're going to teach you some cookie cutter. you already lost me with just saying cookie. You know, I'm not going to be following your path. I like to glean your successful strategies, your work ethic, your discipline, if you have words of wisdom.
That's different.
Not genre, not how often I'm supposed to tweet, other than John telling me to calm down, you know, which I was like, you know what?
I didn't even know if he could do
foolish.
That. See, what he did years ago, I don't think he could do now. You know, see, that's one of the problems. People that 5 or 6 years ago, the plan that they did, that can't work now. That's over. You know what I mean? It's just not, because I know people that have done other plans and done well 5 years ago, and they're still trying to make this comeback because it's so different than it was 5 years ago. I mean,
you know what hasn't changed though, Marsha? You know what hasn't changed though? I'm going to tell you, the thing that helped me the most was my works. So it's your books ultimately that led me to Hollywood. It was my books. I didn't have an agent in Hollywood. I didn't have anybody. I had my books. That's all I had. And my books got me my fan base on social media, which is what John was basically saying, and I tied it back into the books. I mean, I'm not attached. I don't even, honestly, I have 4 sons, you know, they make fun of me because, you know, they got new vocabulary out there for how they talk on media. I don't really, I mean, that's cool for you. You know, I'm too busy working. You know, I'm too busy writing. Virginia said before, she was talking about, and she used the word author. One of the things I tell people is there's a difference between an author and a writer. Author is a past tense word. You become an author when you publish something. So now you're an author. So there's orthodontists out there that made a bed of braces, and they wrote a little book about it. They're an author. And I don't take anything away from that. But there's a difference between being an author and the mentality of being an author, somebody that's utilizing a written product in order to substantiate their or modify or amp up their platform, and a writer. Writers write for a living. And
I think Virginia, I think we lost Virginia, but, you know, Virginia and I have had this conversation that you're saying right now over and over again, because we say there is a big difference between an author and a writer, and that's, there she is. Virginia, are you back?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah, I knew you were. You know, because we were talking about how you always talk about there's a difference between the author and the writer. That's a huge conversation to have with people, because you know what? There is a major difference in the two of those, and you know, that's Virginia and I have a lot of these conversations. That's why I'm so glad that she came on today to hear you, because this, all of the things that you say, and before we get any further, I wanted to say one thing. I know what you wrote about David Bowie, about for your kids, you know, that they,
yes,
you know, and you know, we should talk about this a little, because, you know, Virginia, all of us, I mean, I think anybody out there that knew, you know, of him, which everybody did, is what a great influence he was. And, how much, you know, and the kids still liked him. So do you want to talk for a minute, Gerard, of what you wrote out there? Because I thought that was very, you know, important that people realize.
Well,
because they always say younger people. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge impact. Bowie had a huge, profound impact on lots of Gerard DeMarinis out there. You know, lots of guys back in the 70s that were, you know, artistic and looking for an identity. And what Bowie really did is he showed us that you can be yourself and you can express yourself artistically. And I think one of the things that touched me personally with Bowie was that he did not consider himself a musician. He considered music a tool for him to project his messages. And, and I'm more or less that way. And I always felt a little... I don't know if I want to say ashamed, but I didn't have the dedication to any specific art form. I did play music for a long time. I was a professional and I made a lot of money and I did a lot of things, but I didn't have the dedication or the loyalty to the art form. If I wanted to write a book, I would have jumped in a second. If I would have known that I could have self-published back in the 80s, I probably would have left the rock band at the height of our popularity to write. I just wasn't there yet. But what you were talking about was my wife and I found out that Bowie had passed from my youngest son, Noah, who sent us a text and said, you know, David Bowie died. And I just thought it was kind of cool that
he knew.
We raised
our
boys.
He knew that he would care, and he knew about it.
Well, he knows, I mean, he raised our kids listening to the same music forms that we did. And, you know, rock was only one of them. My second son is a prodigy. He's playing the Smith Center here.
Yeah,
he's a jazz.
I see him on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, he's off the charts. But all four of my children are musicians, and I was just very pleased to see that the youngest acknowledged a guy like David Bowie.
Are you still homeschooling?
They're too old now.
Too old.
We wanted to do it up until high school. So we did it from the time they came out to high school, and now they're out there, and
gave them a lot of cultural. Well, see, because that's one of the things they take, you know, well, as we all know, that sometimes they take those programs out of the schools. And so that was good that you got to be able to get them involved.
We raised four independent thinkers. Whether they're going to be artists is up to them, but I can definitely tell you that we allow them to we're faith-based. You know that we're, you know, a messianic Christian, and so as long as they're doing what's right by our God, that I have no problem with supporting them in any endeavor. There's no dishonorable endeavor. And that's something my dad had taught me. So,
I think that's a great viewpoint. I'm that way with my kids too. You know, as long as the values we instilled in them, they're not, you know, trashing as they go forward in life.
Because
you just want to be decent, you know, people. You know, that's why I was actually just telling my 19-year-old that earlier. You know, I just want you to be someone who contributes to society as a decent human being.
And I think that's so important. I think that's really, really important, because whatever people do, if they do it in the right way and if their parents are behind them, it certainly does help. You know, there's no doubt about that. You know,
yeah, we make all our decisions. We make all our decisions. All four of them actually work for me. So I don't know how that happened, or maybe I work for all four of them. I'm not sure how that works out, but I know
but,
that.
Know, I mean, everybody raises their kids differently, but, you know, the fact is that, you know, when your kids know that you love them, that is such a big deal. I mean, I don't think people get the fact that kids remember the smallest thing that you did for them. It's not always what you gave them. It's something they remember, and all of a sudden they'll say, oh, remember this, and you'll go, like, really? I mean, because they remember what they want to remember. We all do. You know, it's just a small thing, but it's a big thing to them. So, you know,
I think the biggest thing with Lisa and I was Lisa came from modest beginnings. I was downright poor. So, you know, but I built up and was very blessed, and my wife and I have been very blessed in everything we've done. And so all four of my sons that we don't expect them to go back to square zero like we were. Their motivation doesn't have to be money. They can out there and, like Virginia was saying, and do something substantial, you know, do something that brings them joy and that helps others. And that's the coolest thing about the success that I have now.
It's a good way to for your kids. Oh, yeah, I don't want to forget the part about the screenwriting, because that's really important. Okay, now, you know, when I was an agent, and I still am doing this right now, when you write a book, okay, if it's a good book, that will get noticed on the screen sometimes more than a screenplay, because they can get a screenwriter, or if the person's can write a screenplay, but if they like the story, that's the most important thing, is the story. The screenplay, a lot of times in Hollywood, they don't like this screenplay because they want this to happen, and, you know, and that's a problem for screenwriters, because a lot of times a script is really good, but then they rip it to shreds. But if they like a book and the idea, I think you've got a good shot then. I think people, you know, don't realize it, and that's how you got noticed, from your books.
Well, yeah, you know, the problem with screenwriters, and I was talking with the manager of Imagine Dragons, is a good friend of my wife and mine, and he's here in town. And there's a band that sold, I don't even know, 10, 20, 30, 40 million. They you know, really big band. And he wrote 8 screenplays. So I did it.
Yep.
They hired me to do a talk to screenwriters in town, and he showed up. And, I saw him there with his daughter. And he came up to me and he goes, gee, I don't understand, man. He says, you know, I wrote like, I think 8 or 9. And he goes, and I just can't get traction. And he says, I figured, you know, the success of the band and, you know, that would help. And I says, that's not what Hollywood's about, man.
Right.
So my point, my thing is, the problem with writing screenplays is the vehicle for a screenplay is a vehicle to get on film. So whether you're going to do episodic, you're going to do feature film, or whether you're going to do Broadway, you know, it's a vehicle. It's not something that's publishable that you can monetize. And so screenwriters actually get beaten down worse nowadays, much worse, I think, than novelists. And that's because a novelist can at least have the feeling of putting out and publishing the work, and working on your next one, and having that feeling that you reach the end.
You
know
have
what
a
I mean?
Project, right, because a screenplay is not a finished project. And, you know, I published a screenplay just so people could see. I would still like to do that, and I don't think it's a bad idea for people. You know, I published it years ago on Amazon, and because I think if it's done well, I think it could help, but the market is such that when you do a screenplay, it has to be a certain thing, 3-hole paper, this and that. They spend so much time on how perfect that has to be that the writer doesn't even write the story that they want to write. But most of the people that I had options for and whatever, it was on books, you know. It was books.
Yeah.
They were optioning books. And, you know, and sometimes people don't realize that if you're a screenwriter, take your story and – right, that's what I'm doing now. I'm taking all, like, my Grand Central Station that's coming out is from a screenplay. because I love the screenplay, and now I'm writing it into a short novella because I'm still going to try to go out and sell it as a movie, romantic comedy, but I think it will get more notice as a book than it would as a screenplay. So what you're saying is positively true, and I hope when people are listening to that, if you have a screenplay, think about writing it in a book if you can. Because
well,
and
I seriously love more, considering doing that.
Yeah, and I say, Martian, you said perfectly too, because I know a lot of screenwriters don't want to be novelists, and that's
right.
why you've taken yours and put them in a novella, which is short. It's not a full length novel. It's so much shorter. So
yeah,
like
you know why you're saying that, right? Because screenwriters look at novels and they go, "What the heck with that kind of length?" You know.
Yeah.
Screenplays
are
a lot shorter.
Script. You know, we're not always at the script because what happens is in a screenplay, you could say, "Okay, man, 20." I even stopped writing some of the ages in because sometimes if somebody's reading a script that's older than the script, they won't get the pick. That they won't get the feeling that they can do that. Part. So, but you know, you write blonde hair, whatever you do, and I didn't even do that anymore by the time I was done because, you know, you go woman, then that's it because, you know, it can be anybody. But, you know, and that's what people learn out of the script.
Yeah, honestly, and I agree with you on that, Marcia, because, and I'm going to actually take a book series that was turned into movies, but the Percy Jackson middle grade series, The Olympians. They actually took two characters, and it's funny because in the show they call her Athena, but she's got brunette hair, and Athena is actually a blonde because the goddess Athena, hello, blonde. Anyways, but her daughter, all her kids are blondes, but her daughter in the Percy Jackson series in the movie is a brunette, and it's because they combined her with another character, which then they later realized they had to bring that actual character to fruition, which was Clarice, which is Ares' daughter. And it was really kind of funny. I started laughing, and that's why I think
it's
you're
so
right.
So much for Hollywood, right?
Yeah. Well, no, that's what I'm saying. Even in your book, it doesn't matter what, because I've seen so many movies where like you have a certain image of what the character is, or you're like, I could have sworn I remember them saying they had different hair color, and all of a sudden you're seeing like, that's not who that wait, huh? You know. So I agree.
Absolutely.
I think you
it's
none of that matters
true.
Anymore.
All right, Gerard, let's talk about the series. Gerard, I don't want to forget any of these things. I mean, you've got, that's why you're the only guest. You've got so much going on. But, let's talk about the series that you're working on that, you know, is from a previous series.
Are you talking about now, are you
Grizzly.
Talking about Chris De Niro? Or are you talking
No, the Grizzly. We'll do that one first, and then we'll go back to,
You want to do Grizzly?
Yeah, I think we should do that because that's what your newest
okay.
thing is going to be.
Well, Grizzly was a strange. This is what I'm trying to say. Okay, so now last year I did a rock memoir that couldn't come out. It got stalled because of contract breakdown. So I did 5 or 6 months of work on that thing, and I couldn't monetize it, which that really hurt. And then we had party company with one of the partners that I had with Chris De Niro and Chris De Niro Films. And so 2015 didn't start off very, very cool for me. I was like, wow, okay, so one blown project and one where we're kind of floating. And so now as we're working on different things, to tell you the truth, I can't sit still. So they told me to sit still. My manager told me to sit still. My partner told me to sit still. And I went out and wrote a novella.
That might be where we get along here. That might be why I've known you all these years.
Yeah, I mean, you can't sit still, right?
Exactly.
No. So, our manager is the manager of the legendary Tommy Lee Jones, and I love Tommy Lee.
Yeah.
I had written a summary of an idea back in 2010. Which was kind of a the protagonist was going to be this old grizzled cowboy. So now when we signed with Bill Jacobson, I did. Mike was with them forever, but I signed with them. Lo and behold, he's Tommy Lee's representative. So I was like, oh wow, this is cool. So I'm going to finish this story called Joshua's Country. I finish it and. I turned it into Mike, my partner, and I was like, and this is what I'm trying to say. Now, that was a vehicle that I expected totally to be a screenplay, my whole point of that was to get it to Tommy's production company and to see if Tommy wanted to do the movie. And but I didn't write it as a screenplay. I wrote it as a novella. Why?
Right.
Because if anything happens to the project, I can still monetize it and put it out. That's
right.
Why. And that's what I told my friend, the Imagine Dragons manager. I told him, too. I said, instead of written 8 or 9 screenplays that are now gathering dust in your bedroom, you would have 8 or 9 works published and selling all over the world.
Right, exactly. Right.
Now, he turned around and he said, you know, I could never do that. Novels are too long. And that's why Virginia's point is correct. And what you did is smart. Just do a novella. Novella,
yeah.
If you wanted to talk about a written work that's as close as you can get to a screenplay, novella, it's not just the length now. Remember, novella is a specific form, which means you're not doing backstory. You're kind of dropping
yourself
into the story.
Well, maybe you ought to tell people that, right, this is a good thing to tell people, because I think, like, people in criticism with my Virginia Templeton book, Virginia Templeton is from a screenplay. So it's very different, you know. And I probably should write that, put that in the e-book, that it is taken from that, because I think there is a difference in how you write that person. Because it's the here and now. And Jeff Fleischer, who is my editor, he goes insane for me because he's edited all my screenplays and my books, and I can't help it, but I go back and forth in tenses because I'm really writing a screenplay when I'm writing a book because I'm in the here and now, and you can't be. You have to be in a book. You can't be in the here and now unless it's a first person. So, you know, I mean, there's a danger to a person like me, to the editor, because they go crazy. But, you know, but it's true, though. You know, I mean, it is a different form. But see, all right, go finish up. I just wanted to tell you, but that's what you're saying is so right.
Yeah, what I'm saying with that was I actually don't publish it. I give it to my partner, and my partner looks at it and says, hey, loved it, absolutely loved it. He says we're going to move forward with it, and then 2 days later he called me up from Universal Studios in Hollywood, and he says, "Gee, are you sitting down?" He says, "Can I talk to you a second?" I was like, "Yeah, sure." So I thought it was going to be about Joshua's, and he says, "Hey," he says, "I, you know," and Mike Greenberg, my partner, is the most awesome, incredible human being on the face of the earth. He's also reminds me of my wife a little bit in that they both are ADD, so they're extra hyper people, and they're low implementers. I don't know what that means, but my wife keeps telling me that she's. Bottom line, they don't tell me things.
Yeah.
So I am completely in the dark a lot. So he says, remember when I told you that I'm the co-producer of Grizzly Adams? I said, Mike, I've been with you almost 2 years. I never heard you tell me that.
And you would remember that. I think you might remember that.
What are you talking about? He says, oh, so he starts laughing. He goes, oh, yeah. He says, well, you know what? We haven't been doing a lot. We've been doing a lot of research on it, this and that. He goes, well, bottom line, would you like to write the screenplay? I said, for Grizzly Adams? He says, yeah, but it's a different, it's a reboot. It's not the Haggerty one. And I says, yeah, of course, dude. I says, now, I was getting on the phone thinking Joshua's Country is what he was all, so it was a little weird for me. And this is what I'm trying to tell, you know, for all the writers out there, when you have enough works out there, don't be surprised by when your phone rings of what's going to be said to you. Because you think it's going to be one thing, and it's like, what? I got off the phone, and, you know, my wife was like, how was your day? I was like, hey, I'm writing Grizzly Adams. She's like, yeah, right, okay. you never know, G. You're always up to something. I said, well, so anyway, the Grizzly Adams project came, and I said, well, what are we going to do? He says, well, let's write it as a 2-hour feature film, and that may be the pilot that'll kick off an episodic. Mm-hmm. And I says, okay. You know, the difference between writing a feature film, when you're dealing with a historical figure like a Grizzly Adams, is that you would have to go from birth to death, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a feature film. You don't have to do that, but more or less you could do that. The scope of a feature film over 2 hours could take you from the birth of somebody or before to the death and after. Whereas episodic, if it's a pilot, all you're doing is setting up a series.
Yeah,
and that's a lot smaller scope. And so I went back to him and said, hey, they gave me like literally about 150 pages of research. And I got four books that I read on the real guy. And so there was a lot of research. The guy that owns the rights to Grizzlies, a guy named Todd Swindell, really, really talented researcher in Hollywood. And so I had all this research, and a story jumped out to me, but it was, I really thought that it would be powerful as an episodic. So I went back to Mike and says, hey, man, what are we doing? I mean, he says, well, let's just get, he goes, listen, it's starting to get a lot of traction, and it looks like we're going to sign an agency agreement, and but we need a treatment really, 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 really fast. So I was like, okay. This is all like in a scope of 2 days. I said, but what are we doing? I still don't really. He says, gee, I just need you to go. And this is Mike's favorite thing to say to me. I just need you to find the story.
Yeah.
And I said, all right.
Well.
But what is it? If you don't give me, even in a treatment, I still need to know what the scope is. If it's feature film, then I have an idea. But I really wish it was, you know, I mean, you don't get to wish anything.
I think a treatment is like it is harder than writing a book, harder than writing a whole screenplay.
Yeah.
It's very hard because, you know, sometimes when you write a book or a screenplay, you know, till you get to a certain point, you know that the story can make it. I used to always go, if I get to 25 when I'm writing a screenplay, then I got a story. But if I can't get to 25 and make it right, it's no story, you know. Because, and a treatment is tough. I think it's very tough.
Well, I had one event, you're right. I generally don't like treatments because you have to do so much work to do a treatment correctly. You're
right.
Probably very close to writing a screenplay anyway.
Yeah, right.
I mean, to people who think that treatments are summaries, they're not. A treatment is a specific length work. It has to have specific detail. And all that work is already in it. All you didn't do is blow it out another two-thirds, and you probably have a screenplay. But I had an extra advantage. The meetings, the high-level meetings had already taken place. Mike was already in Hollywood had the meeting. And said, we need the answer to the following six questions. And it was like, we need to know the story arc over three seasons. We need to, and as soon as I heard him say seasons, I lit up. Because I don't have any real influence over whether it was going to be feature film or not. But I was like, yes, that is exactly how I pictured this thing. He says, well, but we need character arcs over three seasons. We need story arc over three seasons. He said, we also need to have the cliffhanger endings to the three seasons. They have to be summarized in the treatment. So I was like, all right, cool. Let me. He goes, and you know, take all the time that you want, but just get back to me ASAP. So, and I did, man. It was cool. I was, because I don't know. I am very blessed. I have to tell you, it was exactly what I wanted to do at that point. If he would have said feature film, it would have been. Would have been a struggle because I saw the piece starting in a certain place and ending in a certain place, and really what they wanted to know was the pilot. Ultimately, the treatment was on the pilot, but they wanted to know the questions for the rest of the season, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, the treatment also is because, you know, sometimes in Hollywood, you know, they don't want to sit and read a lot, you know. That's why a lot of times, years ago when I first started with my clients, I would send 10 pages of the script, let's say, to the production company, because if they don't like the first 10 pages, they're not reading any further. It's not going to happen, you know. And it's a very fast-paced market in TV now it's so different because you've got Netflix. You've got a lot. There's a lot more out there for writers than there were before. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, Amazon's got things. You know, a lot of people are going through Amazon. They're going through, you know, and Netflix. Yeah. I've seen, you know, the CEO of Netflix, and he just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Yeah.
Yeah. If anybody's watched the Golden Globes too, I mean, Amazon had quite a few things that were up for nomination, and some stuff that two things I think that won. So I mean, yeah, it's such a true statement about how there's so many options out there, you know, between script
and there wasn't
novelists that we just did not have in the past.
Well, it's a good topic right now. As I was asked on that recently, they says, well, you know, actually I had somebody from a college student write and wanted me to do a Q&A with him for his thesis or something. And I was like,
that's
he says, you know, he's a screenwriter. And
yeah.
he says, you know, what do you think the state? One of the, I think the last question was, what's the state of you know, screenwriting? Where do you think it is? And I said, well, it's there's a good and there's a bad. There's never just good in any era that you'll ever look at.
Right.
The good thing is that there are lots of platforms out there now. So you have all these different distributors. You have all these different kind of digital platforms.
Yeah.
And so there is a big need for content, and content is ultimately written by writers. The thing, though, once you're in it, is that because there's competition, series, episodics, even feature film, but specifically on episodic, there's a lot of competition, so you're not going to have the mashes and the gun smokes of yesteryear that you have, you know, 75% of the nation watching, and you're not going to run for you know, 11 seasons. It's almost... It's very difficult. Let's put it that way. I mean, if you can go out there and if you can get a three season deal, you're blessed as a writer.
If you could get a two, it's good because a lot of times after the first year, you know that you're gone. That's it. It's just the one.
What I was gonna say is from what I've seen recently with script writing. Is when a writer or, you know, the writers room, the group of writers are together working on the series, when they know it's going to be three seasons or five seasons long, I find the story arc is so much stronger than when, honestly, we'll just take Gilligan's Island. You know, my husband uses this one all the time. You know, Gilligan's Island ran for years and years and years. And it was like, what was always the thing? Gilligan screws up, so nobody gets off the dang island. And that was just the constant, you know, storyline every single episode for season after season after season. Where now you get stuff like Breaking Bad or Sons of Anarchy or Mozart in the Jungle and stuff that have like these gorgeous story arcs because they know, okay, we're going to only run three years or we're going to only run 5 years. And I think, you know, so you really, you know where point A is and where point B is. And I love that because I think we're getting stronger writing.
I think that what happens too, what I always wondered about, because I'm a nut for watching, you know, the older stuff and the great series and stuff. And you saw there was a certain formula. And it always seemed to me that even in the best series, that the tail end, the character arcs would start to break down, the story arcs would start to break down. Well, now that I'm in it, I understand why it happens. It's because when we're given a project from a studio, they're basically asking for three seasons. They're not fooling themselves, and it may not go more than one season. But they're going to ask you for where we need to know where you're going to take this thing over three seasons. So let's say in the case of Grizzly Adams, the time between 1849, minor 49, or when he went out west. Because he came from Boston. I learned so much about this guy. It was incredible. I knew nothing about him. I thought the Dan Haggerty guy was the real guy. So what do I know?
Like
but anyway,
the best friend.
Well, from 49 until the biggest part of his life was only 3.5 years. Okay. Same thing when you looked at MASH. MASH covered the Korean War. Well, the Korean conflict lasted 1950 to 1954. How do you run 11 seasons on 1950 to 1954? Obviously, you're not doing a year a season. And when they launched, keep this in mind, they launched the same way that the original Grizzly did. They launched with the movie that was put out by Robert Altman. Altman hated the series. He hated the whole premise for the series. It was a much harder-edged if you ever saw the film.
I love Robert Altman. I'm only sad that he died because I would have loved to work with him because I think I loved him because I loved how he got his characters. He did work with 15, 20 characters. This is how I like to write.
I still like the MASH movie over – I mean, I still watch the series, but I still like the movie over the series.
True. I mean, they're two different things. Like you get a whole different vibe when you watch the MASH movie. Now I'm a MASH. I liked both. I thought that
MASH.
the MASH series was an incredible, iconic. Every aspect of that production, from Alda and all those guys that they picked for the cast, to the writers, some of the greatest writers in Hollywood worked on that. So you know, it was cool. But what I'm saying is, you don't go into it thinking you're going to get 11 seasons out of something.
Never.
So what happens is you really come out with your idea for 3 seasons, and then if it makes it longer than that, you kind of sitting there with a blank canvas and going, all right, what are we going to do?
Well, because you know
what
they
have, you know, in the writer's room.
Well, because they had so many characters. You know, I actually like a lot of characters because I write a lot of characters, and I think you don't get bored as much. I mean, and MASH had a lot of good characters that they could make episodes from. You know, I mean, let's face it, there were not only,
Trapper John,
you know, Alan Alda,
and...
you know, but it was just Trapper. There were so many, you know, and so the writing in those years, these characters, I mean, were really good. That's why I think people that are writing, and if they make a mistake by not watching some of the older things, because when you watch old movies or you watch old shows, it's, there's so much more to the character than you see now, because that's just how they wrote then. And you get a depth of a character by really looking at how they wrote things. You know, it was just character driven. It wasn't really about, you know, like now, because there's so much special effects. But these were just characters that were in your home or you went to see a movie. People love that, and I think it's very good for a writer to do that, to look at old things and see how they wrote, because some of those writers were incredible. I mean, they were unbelievable.
And the writers nowadays, trust me, you're talking about Breaking Bad and Longmire and a lot of these great House of Cards. There's so many great series out there. The writers that are working on them are—they're not too far from me. We're a bunch of nerds that grew up in the '60s and the '70s and watching TV when TV was, you know, five channels, seven channels.
Right, Mad Men started kind of like, you know, in where people would start loving characters like that. I mean, they got so attached to them in the newer market, you know, because, like, for years it wasn't like that. But then when Mad Men came out, people started, and he won a Golden Globe, John Hamm, now, you know, for the last season, which is a good way to go out, you know, that people, after all those years, I love that show. I mean, I just kept looking at that show and thinking, like, oh, my God. You know, and they were going to do a spinoff, I don't know, of the women in it, because, you know, when you're watching how the women were treated, you know, as employees, it was like, oh, okay, nothing. But, you know, and they were so good that, but I don't know if they're going to do any spinoffs with it. But Matthew Weiner, he's an incredible. They were incredible. I mean, I thought his writing and his storylines were great. So that's what's happening now. So if you can get involved in doing series, I think it's going to be great for you, because you're going to really, you know, because you get, you know, you are in depth, like with your Chris. So you want to talk about Chris a little, just to talk about, because you get involved in the character, which a lot of writers think they do, but they don't do it. You do it so well. Do you want to talk about your series?
Sure. Well, we have a great, it was supposed to happen right after this radio show. I'm going to be talking to, I don't know if you ever heard of Cassian Elwes. Cassian was the, for about 12 years, I think, he was the head of independent film for William Morris Agency.
Wow.
Before that, he was the guy that wrote Oxford Blues. His dad was a famous independent producer, Elliot Kastner, who, oddly enough, my partner Mike Greenberg knows Elliot real well. And
really?
It seems like Mike knows everybody. Because Mike started his career with Paul Newman and George England and Marlon Brando and all these guys out of Warner Brothers. And he knows his dad. Anyway, we're going to be talking to him tomorrow about Chris De Niro. We're hoping to – I pray that Cassian will come on board and become a partner with us, because he's raised the financing for 297 films.
Yeah,
incredible.
That's hard. That's the hardest thing is to do, you know, it's the financing. That's the problem. It's the that's, you know, if people, you know, they don't understand that that's the financing. And, you know, you could have the best script and they want to do it, but if they can't get financing or distribution, you can't have that film done. And that's one of the things where Amazon and all these other digitals are helping people, because, you know, there's a lot of independents that just can't do that. That's where I had an option on one of my screenplays, and that's why I opened Michigan Avenue Media, and then the market dropped, everything got bad, and then I couldn't go and get money. You know, I'm not like a huge, you know, screenwriter that people knew, and they're not going to take chances, you know, and that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, on the independent side, that's what makes it independent. It's the money is, the financing is coming from sources outside the studio, and but he's an amazing guy. Let me see here.
Well, you have a character.
What's that now?
When you do characters like that, you hope that people will like them, because, you know, when you do a deep character that has so much depth, that's all. Somewhere along the line, it's a good story, and someone will find it. That's why I named my show "A Good Story." It was a good story because that's what my manager used to say to me, just write a good story. And that's really basically the best advice you can give someone, is write the best story you can write.
Well, that's what garnered the attention. That's why I say, you know, you just write things, you don't know who's going to read them, and if you keep writing. And I was working on my ninth and tenth Chris DeNiro and Archangel book when I got the first phone call for Watchmen. You know, it takes a lot of years. People you know, that's why you should – here's the thing you shouldn't do as a writer. Don't wait around, all right? You write a piece. You know, you want to spread the word. You use social media to let everybody know out there. Social media is kind of a funny thing. Facebook and Twitter are very, very different things. Facebook are normally friends. Telling friends that you put something out has never been one of my I'm not trying to sell to you know, the guys I went to grammar school with.
I know.
So,
I know this.
You know, but
trust
Twitter
me,
is a good shout. What's that?
Some people that know me, they don't even know what I do. I don't really talk about me when I'm out. You know, I talk so much about me and things like this when I'm on the radio show, and that's what they don't even know. They'll go, like, I had a book signing with all my books there. They were like, when did you write this? I mean, it's like, I think that they would know, but I don't talk about it because, you know, they're my friends. I'm not going to go sit, buy my book, you know. So you want the world,
you
know, the outside.
You don't want to be marketing to your friends. You're not going to have many friends for very long. So
I don't want to walk in a room and go, oh, there she is. You know, she's going to try to sell her book. You know, instead of that, what I do is I give people books, you know. But I don't, you know, I always feel bad, you know, pushing myself, which in some ways is not great either. But I think it's better to try to push yourself out to the world rather than just to your friends. It's not, you know, you want to be discreet in some ways where they're not like, going to have to buy something for you every time they see you.
Yeah, but I just think that once you let people know, regardless of whether they're strangers, you know, friends and family, I'm sure, are going to find out somehow. But
they do.
Talking about the rest of the world,
shout it out
and then move on. That's the thing is to move on. You should already be scoping out your next project. Three quarters of the way of the project that you have in. Every time I say this to a group of writers, I get yelled at. They're like, "Oh, you know, it's so difficult. You know, I'm so focused on my one thing." Well, then, don't. As my brother would say, "Good luck with that," because I don't know how you can how it's going to work out for you if you think that you're going to turn out one work a year and think that you're going to you're hoping to do like The Help. I mean, you know, you think I sold a couple of 100,000 copies of my books. It's taken 5 years. You know, it's not millions. It's you know, I mean, like I said, I started out slower than most everybody. I could care less. I knew that if I listened to you know, I followed this guy, Dean Wesley Smith, a great, great, prolific writer. And he was the one to tell a bunch of us, just keep writing. You built a nice bakery, Gene, but you only got one cherry pie in it. You got to stock the shelves with your works.
Yeah.
And good things are going to happen.
That's really true. It really is true. You know,
that's the advice I always say about the difference between a writer and an author, which is not even from me. That actually came from Jack Remick, an author, Martian, I know. And
he'll be on our show in two weeks. He'll be on
and that's,
with us.
And that's,
yes.
that's actually, and I think Jack got, and I think Jack actually told me he got that from somewhere, but I don't remember. Maybe. But that's the thing. He's like, you know, exactly that. He's like, even if you only have one book published, you know, if you want to be called an author, you need to have completed manuscripts sitting on a bookshelf that you're shopping and trying to get out. That's an author. A writer, somebody who writes and then for years doesn't do anything and then writes again and doesn't do anything for years. That's a writer.
But you got to keep writing. You have to, you know, you really do. And that was my goal always, is to tell people to keep writing. And, you know, especially, you know, like in your case, you know, Gerard, I mean, your writing is very strong on its own. I mean, you're a very thorough writer. I mean, you really are, and you're descriptive. You have it all. So that's why they're looking for you, because you may not have set out to be the way you are, but you are. You're very thorough, and you can see that there's so much that goes on in your characters' lives, and that's okay, because your writing is strong, and that's what people work years to get. You started out that way. You just didn't know it.
The first book that people read was not the first thing I ever wrote. And so people understand, you know, they used to have the theory that you had to write a million words. And, well, nobody ever said that you have to publish a million words. Writing is a practice. It's an exercise just like anything else. I probably have easily written twice that in my lifetime. It's just that I didn't publish until 2011. So maybe my book came out a little bit stronger on the on the writing side, although, you know, you look at it, I'm sure you both feel the same way. You look at your first work and you're like, ay, 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 you know.
Yeah. I see why this didn't happen, you know, and then, you know, and then on the other side, sometimes when you look at your work later on, you go, well, maybe that wasn't so bad. You know,
I totally hear what you're saying, because my first writing, I have over 50 titles published in the magazine market, because that's actually where I started. And I look back at some of the stuff that I was on assignment, you know, to go write and, you know, worked on, that never ended up in a magazine issue. And some of them, I'm like, oh, I'm so sad that didn't get in there. But I would tell you about 65% of it, I'm like, thank God that never got published. That's terrible.
That's the way it is. I mean, that's a real writer story, because we've all done that, and that's part of it. I mean, anybody that thinks they're going to come out and write, you know, Shakespeare from the first word that you put on paper, well, then you're a better man than I, Gungor Din, because it's not normal.
Right,
it's,
but to keep going, to keep going is so important. I mean, and it really is, and you can see where Grizzly Adams, I mean, these are opportunities coming to you because you continued. Had you have stopped, no, that would be it. You wouldn't be having those opportunities. So that is the message to everybody, I think, from all three of us right now, is that just keep writing and, you know, hopefully someone will notice you. If not, just keep writing till they do, and they will.
Your point should be to write the best work that you can write each and every time that you write.
Yeah.
And rinse and repeat and go out there. And then in 10 years, 5 years, 10 years, look back at your body of work and you will have accomplished something.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the social network. It's not going to be the tweet that you sent out last year that's going to matter. It's going to be the book that you published last year that's going to matter.
Exactly. The truth is, you know, you have to do all the social media, but you have to do it in moderation. You have to figure out, you know, what's best for you. But mostly writing is the best thing you can do. And because, as you said, you know, this is about finding readers. You're not looking to, I mean, yes, we all like to have friends, whatever, but these friends, I hate to say this to people, but I, over the last 6 years, there are so many people that I knew that were out there that are gone now because they just couldn't take it. And so if you concentrate on that, you don't want to be one of them that just gets out of the game. You want to be one that's still there. I mean, you know, you want to have staying power.
And I'm not very specific. If I was one of the guys that had no real interest in Hollywood, I love watching movies, I love TV, but I love writing books. It's what I did. I did it well. I make money from it. I'm willing to do this for the rest of my life until they put me in a box. But it's funny, when the opportunity came, I jumped on it, and I kind of gave up. I gave up two novels now that I would have had out to do this, and I'm kind of glad I did. Mike says you were a born scriptwriter, and I says, all right. Well,
I think he's right about that because scriptwriters really, they need to see it, and you see it. See, and that's because you do watch movies. I used to call production companies, and I'd say, oh, did you see this movie? They go like, no, we don't go to movies. I'm going like, what? I mean, that's why they can't tell a good screenplay when they see it, because they're not even looking at movies. You have to read, you have to go to movies. I mean, because you have to watch what's out there and how they write and what attracts people. And I like to go to a movie theater because I like to see what people say when they're walking out of the movie. I want to hear, my husband's always laughing, he's already out, okay, the door, and I'm sitting there, I'm wanting to watch what people say, and if they'll say, oh, I hated that movie, or I loved it, but when they walk out happy, I feel like the writer and everybody on the crew has done a great job. When you have an audience that walks out happy, this is like the best feeling.
You want to know for me what I think because I think as writers, we all are a little more critical than just a normal person walking in and seeing a film or reading a book. I think my criteria is always this. If I don't think I could have rewrote it, writers are naturally, when I'm sitting, I'm watching or I'm reading something, I'd say to myself, oh man, I would have took that a different way.
Yeah, I know.
That doesn't mean that it sucks now.
Try to go on the show with me.
I'll take you guys one more further. This drives my head. He's actually petitioned to never go with me to a movie or even to talk about a book that we both have read anymore, because if I can guess how it's going to end within the first like five chapters of a book or like within the first like 10 minutes of the movie, that's it for me. I'm like, that was too predictable. I'm like, oh gosh, my husband's like, and I'll tell him, I'll tell him right away, like when we go to a movie, this is how it's going to end. And I kid you not, he'll turn to me and go, can you just shut up? I'll be right. And he's just laughing.
Yeah, because it's true. Though, while we're watching the movie, I'm going like, I'm saying the lines myself, what I think it should be. Looking at me, you can't help yourself. It's because that's what we do, and you're always going like, what kind of line was that? Did they say? And that's just how it is. But to leave everybody today, I mean, I'm so happy that Virginia's actually here today with me to have you on the show, Gerard, because because Gerard, I mean, you gave so much information you know so much about this that this is really helpful to people listening out there, because you've been in a different genre, you're in a different, light, because screenwriting is different. And I think when you do both, it shows you both sides,
Consider myself a writer. I'm going to have, there's lots of novels that are going to come out I'm very honored to be working with Mike Greenberg. I like Mike Greenberg.
I think it's fabulous. I look at myself as a screenwriter. See, that's what happens. We all do what we need. That's just what we think, because I see myself as a screenwriter, and I do write books, but I do it for the reason that, and I'm glad to hear that it's actually something that's still happening, is because they look at a book and then they'll say, oh, yeah, this is, this could be a movie, and that's my goal.
Oh, there's no doubt. It's how it happened with me. I know they say that's not the way you should. I would not endorse going around Hollywood with your novel. Yeah. But I can tell you that's how it happened for me. I got a phone call.
They read novels. They absolutely read novels. If you look at the movies, and you will see that when you see it's based on, it's always based on a novel by, even based on a story by, and that's really what appears in the movies a lot of times. There's not as many scripts without being adapted from a book, as people think. They're adapted.
I know. I know there's agents now that, and not all of them do this, but there are some. There's a handful of them that do it. That when they have an author that they really see being a strong you know, force in the publishing world that they'll tell them, you know what, I love your novel. We're going to, you know, try, we're going to push it. We're going to get published, but you might want to consider doing a screenplay to sit with it. And
well,
some of them can't, though.
Some people really can't. You know, I used to always think that they could, but the truth is some can't, you know, because screenwriting is completely different. And, you know, you really have to edit yourself out when you write a screenplay.
I'm just saying there are agents, though.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't know if those authors go find somebody who can write a script for them.
I don't know.
But I know that there are some agents that actually like to have them side by side.
Well,
I'll tell you,
even the people that can write a screenplay, remember what you're asking a writer. So if I put out a book and I know that the book is going to sell a couple hundred thousand copies every time I write one, you're asking me to replace that because it's the same time. It's going to take me 5 months to write a novel or to write a screenplay. So now you're talking about the economics of not taking the time to put out the novel. So you know, there's always that. I mean, for me, I didn't have an agent. I can tell you though, you should definitely work spheres of influence. So if you know people that have the ability to get the book into the hands of other people, definitely send them a comp copy of your.
Well, I do that. I mean, I've done that, you know, for years. But I know that, you know, I still am a WGA agent, you know, but, you know, you can't really, you know, so I know what's absolutely going on out there. The fact is that a lot of people, you know, think that I did that in my career, telling people maybe you can try this in a book, and sometimes it doesn't work for people, you know, to do both, you know. But I think that it's great if you can get an agent, but the truth is you can get an agent when you start getting successful. Unfortunately, I had hundreds of clients, and they never had an agent, and I tried. And one of the reasons that they don't take new people is because they want them to keep producing, and some of them can't, you know, and it'll never happen. So I think that's why they want to make sure. That's why with you, Gerard, they see your body of work. They know you're dedicated and you can do this.
Well,
you know.
But remember too, I handed the book out. I'm the type of guy that turns over every shelf. So bottom line, I looked at the people that I know that are influencers. I came from a rock band. We produced two albums, so I contacted my producer, believe it or not, and sent him a copy of the book. He, a guy named Jeff Glicksman, he's the guy that produced Kansas, and so. When I sent it out to Glicks, and I knew that he liked to read, and I says, hey, man, just not for anything, not asking him to do anything. I just says, hey, here's the book. Just put the books into the hands of the people that you have respect for and that are movers and shaker. Well, he handed it to the drummer from Kansas. The drummer from Kansas handed it to an executive producer in Hollywood. That's how that's really where the Hollywood side of my career started. And you know how long that took? 3 years. I didn't hear from Jeff again for three years.
I know.
So that's why I said, what are you going to do? You can't just sit around waiting for a phone to ring.
Exactly.
A writer should be writing, and then the phone just starts to ring, you know?
Right. And now I think we could end the show a little, but I want you to say, okay, where can they find you?
They can find me on Amazon, Gerard DeMarini, and you can find me at GerardDeMarini.com. And CDN Film, so Chris De Niro, CDNFilmCorp.com is what we're using right now, just as a banner out there for the film side.
Okay, and I have on our blog page from Blog Talk, I have your links so they can find you on through there.
Yeah,
too.
And you can find me on Facebook,
you're
can find me on Twitter.
Now, and I really hope you come on again. I actually think that one time you and Jack Remick, I think that would be a great show because Jack is someone to meet. He's just so interesting. I mean, he's done a lot of stuff in his life, and Virginia and I mean, he, you know, some of the people that Virginia and I have had on the shows, I mean, you know, we like our guests, but, you know, I like everybody that's been on my shows because I've learned from them. But some people really should belong with each other. Like, because last time I had you on with Ben Lieberman, and you guys got along great. That was
fun. We actually hit it off, and we're Facebook buddies now.
Yes,
so,
I know. You know, so, I mean, those are friendships that will probably last because you've talked to each other in person. That we need to do more communicating that way. You know, that's why the shows
true.
Are good. Yeah, it is. And I hope you'll come back again and keep me posted on what's going on with you, because I'm really happy for you, and I think that you're going to have a great career. You already do. You don't need me to say that. You've got, you're on your way. This is great.
Thanks so much to both of you. It was great talking
to you. Take care. Okay. All right. Keep in touch. All right. Bye-bye. Virginia, don't you have to go?
Yeah.
I think you're yes, you
yeah,
do.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, next week I have a show, and do you have any shows coming up? Or, next week is with Mike Pettit. And,
no,
I think it's
I'm pretty much back scenes now for World of Ink, except when I do shows with you. And then, of course, if authors come on, you know, want to come on to promote their books, I'm still doing those shows. But, you know, those only come up when someone wants to do a, you know, like Gerard just said, you know, blast their book and get it out there and then move on and start writing again. So,
I think we should have Jack and I think Jack and Gerard would be great together, because they just have been, they both do a lot of, you know, a lot of times it does overlap in a field, you know, where you're, you know, start as a screenwriter or, you know, because Jack did screenplays and then he does books. I mean, I think that people don't realize how much they, you know, have in common sometimes, but a lot of people don't want to try to do both. But I think Gerard, I always knew he was going to be great. I mean, his books are very thorough. All right, and so we didn't get him to talk about Audible and things like that, but I'll be talking about that maybe next week with Mike, and if you want to join us, it'll be fine. I have like 8 shows planned, and I think we're going to have some sizzling hot shows, because people love those. And because there's a lot of romance writers, like, that's what they wanted Gerard to be. You know, I mean, there's tons, you know. So, I mean, we have horror writers and everybody, and so it's always so much fun to interview all these people and have them on, because, you know, and we need to have some children's shows, and Mikey Brooks will be joining us soon to do his own show. And so that will be soon. And I think Willow, I hope she comes back and does, I think she is going to come back to do some of the paranormal. So I think we're good on this.
Yeah. It's going to be a fun new year. So
it's
going to
be fun. I can't believe it. It's another year. Right, so it's 5-year anniversary for us, because I'm thinking like, this is good. So I'm so glad you came today, because I think, Gerard, you've not been on with him, and he's so interesting.
No, I haven't. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So take care, and thank you, everybody, for being on, and I'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.